An alle Aufsichtspersonen: Verteilen Sie jetzt die Aufgabenbogen für den Prüfungsteil Hörverstehen. Die Prüfung beginnt in 2 Minuten. An die Kandidatinnen und Kandidaten: Beschriften Sie jetzt das Deckblatt des Aufgabenbogens Hörverstehen. Achtung! Lesen Sie die Aufgaben erst, wenn der englische Text beginnt. Berufsmaturität Wirtschaft 2019, Englisch Serie C. Sie können jetzt zur ersten Aufgabe gehen. This part of the examination consists of 3 different listening comprehension tasks. There will be pauses before and after each task to give you time to read the questions and to check your answers. You will hear each task twice. Student Exchange Program. In the first part of the test, you will hear the head teacher of a school talking to a group of parents about an international student exchange program. As you listen, fill in the gaps 1 to 10 in the notes below with 1 to 3 words. You now have 90 seconds in which to look at task 1. Ready?
Good evening. I'd like to welcome all those parents whose children have just started at the school. The purpose of this meeting is to give you information about our international exchange program known as Family Abroad. For 1 week per year, pupils are invited to stay with a host family and attend school with a child the same age. A return visit is then arranged 6 months later. In general, children aged 13 to 15 years old seem to get the most out of this trip. Now, I realise that your own children will only be 11 or at most 12 this year, but we want them to start writing to their prospective overseas partners a year or so before the visit. This will make their future exchange more successful, as they will already know someone in and a lot about their destination before they leave. We've established links with schools in various countries. In the past, European exchanges have been the most popular, especially amongst children keen to practice their languages. But this is not the only aim of the programme, so those more interested in other subjects should not be put off. One year, we organised a trip to Holland, which was very successful, although none of the children were studying Dutch. Our most regular destination, however, is France, with Germany coming a close second. Although we are in touch with a school in Poland, which is very keen to take part, as is a school in Canada. Now, although most children love the experience, we must be prepared for some difficulties. This may be the child's first trip abroad, leading to feelings of homesickness as well as loneliness. A week can seem a long time when you feel lonely or you're missing home. So, each group of pupils is accompanied by a professional group leader, which means there's always someone with training on the spot to solve any difficulties, which is a relief for both parents and host families, as you can imagine. There is a variety built into the week, and this definitely helps. For example, children attend lessons together in the morning and then visit a local place of interest in the afternoon. These trips can be fun as well as educationally valuable, and parents are invited to come along too. In the past, we managed to combine the pure entertainment of places like theme parks with the learning opportunities provided by wildlife parks, museums, etc. And surprisingly, it's actually the wildlife rather than the theme parks which prove the most popular time and time again.
Now listen again and check your answers. Ready?
Good evening. I'd like to welcome all those parents whose children have just started at the school. The purpose of this meeting is to give you information about our international exchange programme known as Family Abroad. For 1 week per year, pupils are invited to stay with a host family and attend school with a child the same age. A return visit is then arranged 6 months later. In general, children aged 13 to 15 years old seem to get the most out of this trip. Now, I realise that your own children will only be 11 or at most 12 this year, but we want them to start writing to their prospective overseas partners a year or so before the visit. This will make their future exchange more successful, as they will already know someone in and a lot about their destination before they leave. We've established links with schools in various countries. In the past, European exchanges have been the most popular, especially amongst children keen to practice their languages. But this is not the only aim of the programme, so those more interested in other subjects should not be put off. One year, we organised a trip to Holland, which was very successful, although none of the children were studying Dutch. Our most regular destination, however, is France, with Germany coming a close second. Although we are in touch with a school in Poland, which is very keen to take part, as is a school in Canada. Now, although most children love the experience, we must be prepared for some difficulties. This may be the child's first trip abroad, leading to feelings of homesickness as well as loneliness. A week can seem a long time when you feel lonely or you're missing home. So, each group of pupils is accompanied by a professional group leader, which means there's always someone with training on the spot to solve any difficulties, which is a relief for both parents and host families, as you can imagine. There is a variety built into the week, and this definitely helps. For example, children attend lessons together in the morning and then visit a local place of interest in the afternoon. These trips can be fun as well as educationally valuable, and parents are invited to come along too. In the past, we managed to combine the pure entertainment of places like theme parks with the learning opportunities provided by wildlife parks, museums, etc. And surprisingly, it's actually the wildlife rather than the theme parks which prove the most popular time and time again.
This is the end of task one. You now have 30 seconds to check your answers. Now turn to task 2. Interview with a novelist. In the second part of the test, you will hear an interview with a well-known novelist and biographer. For questions 1 to 8, mark the best answer, A, B, or C. You now have 90 seconds in which to look at task 2. Ready?
With us today to discuss his career is Frank Thompson, renowned novelist and biographer. So let's start at the beginning, Frank. You did say some years ago that you began high on the mountain only to go down sharply while others were passing you on the way up. Do you think now when you look back at your first novel that it had anything that you were not able to capture in your later novels?
You can't write a book that's worth reading, or you can't continue to be a reasonable writer if you just try to do the same thing again. So there are all sorts of positive things in my first book that I'll never achieve again, like the easiness of the dialogue or the kind of simple elegance that comes from not trying to be too clever. But to be honest, I also wouldn't want to repeat this style again.
Now, after the tremendous success of that first novel, your second one was pretty much torn apart by the critics. That must have hurt.
It was shocking. You know, this is going to sound silly, but I couldn't believe the intensity of the attack on it. I remember one awful review by a long-standing, well-known critic who was probably trying to be especially funny. He wrote that the book was paceless, tasteless, graceless. Now, it certainly had its faults, but it definitely had pace. It had its own kind of taste, and I like to think it had some grace. It was almost as if the reviewer had deliberately wanted to pick the few good things he could find in the book and ruin them too. He just completely destroyed the book.
But did this rejection push you in a different direction?
It left me very confused. I thought maybe I should give up and become something else, but I didn't know what. So I wandered around and finally started thinking about the next book, The Black Tree. Of course, you get good reviews too, which give you hope, and the bad ones make you tougher. Finally, after many, many years, you realize that it's part of it, in a way. It's a selection process. Only the people who are really driven to be writers actually make it through. That's why there are far more people who write two novels than six or seven.
After a while, people began to see some autobiographical content in your fiction. Is that true?
More or less. You don't ever put someone into a book completely. You don't dare, because if you do, you've got a boring character. The point is that if you put people into a book that you know very well, like your wife or children, they're real for you already, so you don't have to create them. So they say a few things that they say every day, and they're real for you, but not for anyone else. It's better if you transform them to a degree, for example, by putting them in an occupation they don't have in real life.
And what do you think about some of the novels written today with their extremely violent plots?
I don't care what characters do in a novel. I'm willing to read about the worst human criminal, provided the novelist can make that person come alive. A novel should make it possible to learn more about the depths of human nature. Some of today's violent novels don't do that. There's no inner voyage. The writing's descriptive, but it doesn't reveal anything about the characters. I think you can go as far as you want, as long as your imagination is equal to it.
So the novel is still mainly a kind of psychological journey?
Well, it can be many things. A riddle, a game, or a wonderful revolution of language. I would hate to say novels have to be just one thing. But the key is that they should illustrate human experience in a dramatic way. Otherwise, why read them? You're going to get a better, swiftly paced modern narrative on the average TV show.
You have also written a number of biographies. Is there one aspect which attracted you to all these people?
Well, yes. I think I'm in a good position to write about people who are well known. Not necessarily because I'm as large a celebrity as they are, but because I think I have more insight into them than the average biographer. They tend to approach from the outside and don't understand the incredible confusion of identities that grows when you come to celebrity from simpler beginnings. That's what draws me to these people.
What do you like about writing biographies?
You have the great advantage of knowing what happened. When you're a novelist, you panic about what to do next. You could ruin the book if you go the wrong way. With a biography, you don't have to worry about that.
Okay, now let's turn to your latest novel, which has...
Now listen again and check your answers. Ready?
With us today to discuss his career is Frank Thompson, renowned novelist and biographer. So let's start at the beginning, Frank. You did say some years ago that you began high on the mountain only to go down sharply while others were passing you on the way up. Do you think now when you look back at your first novel that it had anything that you were not able to capture in your later novels?
You can't write a book that's worth reading, or you can't continue to be a reasonable writer if you just try to do the same thing again. So there are all sorts of positive things in my first book that I'll never achieve again, like the easiness of the dialogue or the kind of simple elegance that comes from not trying to be too clever. But to be honest, I also wouldn't want to repeat this style again.
Now, after the tremendous success of that first novel, your second one was pretty much torn apart by the critics. That must have hurt.
It was shocking. You know, this is going to sound silly, but I couldn't believe the intensity of the attack on it. I remember one awful review by a long-standing, well-known critic who was probably trying to be especially funny. He wrote that the book was paceless, tasteless, graceless. Now, it certainly had its faults, but it definitely had pace. It had its own kind of taste, and I like to think it had some grace. It was almost as if the reviewer had deliberately wanted to pick the few good things he could find in the book and ruin them too. He just completely destroyed the book.
But did this rejection push you in a different direction?
It left me very confused. I thought maybe I should give up and become something else, but I didn't know what. So I wandered around and finally started thinking about the next book, The Black Tree. Of course, you get good reviews too, which give you hope, and the bad ones make you tougher. Finally, after many, many years, you realize that it's part of it, in a way. It's a selection process. Only the people who are really driven to be writers actually make it through. That's why there are far more people who write two novels than six or seven.
After a while, people began to see some autobiographical content in your fiction. Is that true?
More or less. You don't ever put someone into a book completely. You don't dare, because if you do, you've got a boring character. The point is that if you put people into a book that you know very well, like your wife or children, they're real for you already, so you don't have to create them. So they say a few things that they say every day, and they're real for you, but not for anyone else. It's better if you transform them to a degree, for example, by putting them in an occupation they don't have in real life.
And what do you think about some of the novels written today with their extremely violent plots?
I don't care what characters do in a novel. I'm willing to read about the worst human criminal, provided the novelist can make that person come alive. A novel should make it possible to learn more about the depths of human nature. Some of today's violent novels don't do that. There's no inner voyage. The writing's descriptive, but it doesn't reveal anything about the characters. I think you can go as far as you want, as long as your imagination is equal to it.
So the novel is still mainly a kind of psychological journey?
Well, it can be many things. A riddle, a game, or a wonderful revolution of language. I would hate to say novels have to be just one thing. But the key is that they should illustrate human experience in a dramatic way. Otherwise, why read them? You're going to get a better, swiftly paced modern narrative on the average TV show.
You have also written a number of biographies. Is there one aspect which attracted you to all these people?
Well, yes. I think I'm in a good position to write about people who are well known. Not necessarily because I'm as large a celebrity as they are, but because I think I have more insight into them than the average biographer. They tend to approach from the outside and don't understand the incredible confusion of identities that grows when you come to celebrity from simpler beginnings. That's what draws me to these people.
What do you like about writing biographies?
You have the great advantage of knowing what happened. When you're a novelist, you panic about what to do next. You could ruin the book if you go the wrong way. With a biography, you don't have to worry about that.
Okay, now let's turn to your latest novel, which has...
This is the end of task 2. Now turn to task 3. Managing a restaurant chain. In the third part of the test, you will hear a radio interview with the managing director of a restaurant chain. For questions 1 to 5, decide whether the statements are true or false. Correct the false ones using up to 5 keywords. You now have 30 seconds in which to look at task 3. Ready?
I have in the studio with me today Sita Bakshi, who set up the Punjab Grill with her brother Rahul in 2010 when she was 30. They now have a restaurant chain with £20 million turnover. Sita, what gave you the drive to achieve so much at such a young age?
Well, our parents taught us the important lesson that you should never be afraid of failure. But really, it was when we moved to England from India when I was a teenager. I felt like an outsider because of my accent and interests. So that gave me a strong desire to do better at school than those who'd always lived here. I felt I needed to be educated. I was more likely to take chances.
So what do you think has made you successful as a businesswoman? What is it that makes someone able to progress as an entrepreneur in the business world?
Well, in my case, I think it's more a reflection of my mental capacity than all the books I've read and the skills I've learned at university. I mean, I can write a good letter now, but that isn't going to make me successful. But I've got a fundamental understanding of business. I can see very easily in my mind how things are going to go.
Okay, let's move on now to talk about your career. First, you got into the soft drinks business.
Yes, that's right. But we soon found that importing drinks is a bit of a dull business. Nothing much was happening. So we sold up in 2007 and thought, what shall we do now? We decided to go traveling for a year, but we wanted to work while traveling. Then, when we were in India, we met someone in the drinks industry who had a chain of restaurants there. He took us on. My brother was a waiter and I was working in the office doing a lot of the day-to-day running of the restaurant. And in doing that, I learned the basics such as what to buy, how many chefs to employ and so on.
And you stayed there until 2010?
Yes. Then we came back here and started the Punjab Grill straight away.
Some people say that running a restaurant is tough work.
There's no doubt that it is. Some staff don't go home until 4:30 in the morning, but then they might not be on until the next evening. I only work during the day, I might add. I like to have some time to myself, but most people in the restaurant business aren't like me. People in the business tend to be outgoing, sociable types, the sort who enjoy an environment of constant activity and tight deadlines.
What would you say to anyone who's thinking of going into the catering business?
I'd say start at the bottom. Interestingly, one of the institutions here is developing a recruitment technique based not on degrees and work experience, but on the ability to learn. The food industry still maintains the idea of apprenticeship. Running a restaurant, working with the public, these are very complex skills, and you must be prepared to start at the bottom and learn quickly.
Well, thank you for coming along to the studio today, Sita, and I wish you every success.
Now listen again and check your answers. Ready?
I have in the studio with me today Sita Bakshi, who set up the Punjab Grill with her brother Rahul in 2010 when she was 30. They now have a restaurant chain with £20 million turnover. Sita, what gave you the drive to achieve so much at such a young age?
Well, our parents taught us the important lesson that you should never be afraid of failure. But really, it was when we moved to England from India when I was a teenager. I felt like an outsider because of my accent and interests. So that gave me a strong desire to do better at school than those who'd always lived here. I felt I needed to be educated. I was more likely to take chances.
So what do you think has made you successful as a businesswoman? What is it that makes someone able to progress as an entrepreneur in the business world?
Well, in my case, I think it's more a reflection of my mental capacity than all the books I've read and the skills I've learned at university. I mean, I can write a good letter now, but that isn't going to make me successful. But I've got a fundamental understanding of business. I can see very easily in my mind how things are going to go.
Okay, let's move on now to talk about your career. First, you got into the soft drinks business.
Yes, that's right. But we soon found that importing drinks is a bit of a dull business. Nothing much was happening. So we sold up in 2007 and thought, what shall we do now? We decided to go traveling for a year, but we wanted to work while traveling. Then, when we were in India, we met someone in the drinks industry who had a chain of restaurants there. He took us on. My brother was a waiter and I was working in the office doing a lot of the day-to-day running of the restaurant. And in doing that, I learned the basics such as what to buy, how many chefs to employ and so on.
And you stayed there until 2010?
Yes. Then we came back here and started the Punjab Grill straight away.
Some people say that running a restaurant is tough work.
There's no doubt that it is. Some staff don't go home until 4:30 in the morning, but then they might not be on until the next evening. I only work during the day, I might add. I like to have some time to myself, but most people in the restaurant business aren't like me. People in the business tend to be outgoing, sociable types, the sort who enjoy an environment of constant activity and tight deadlines.
What would you say to anyone who's thinking of going into the catering business?
I'd say start at the bottom. Interestingly, one of the institutions here is developing a recruitment technique based not on degrees and work experience, but on the ability to learn. The food industry still maintains the idea of apprenticeship. Running a restaurant, working with the public, these are very complex skills. And you must be prepared to start at the bottom and learn quickly.
Well, thank you for coming along to the studio today, Sita, and I wish you every success.
This is the end of task 3. You now have 2 minutes to check your answers. This is the end of the listening comprehension test. Stop writing and hand in your papers.